Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
Joel, you and I, we love hearing from our listeners, and specifically, we love to get great questions, and we've got some great ones this week. We have one question in regards to a cash-out refi in order to pay for some student loans. We're going to talk about Section 8 landlording. We're also going to talk about some lump sum investing, man. We're going to get to those three plus two others on this episode.
Yeah, there's a lot to say about all of those. Yeah, plus a couple other questions. Looking forward to this one. Matt, before we get into it, I wanted to let you know that I had to buy a door for one room in our house that just hasn't had a door for like the 5 years we've lived in it. It's we hung a curtain up for a while just to give that kind of, that was like the partition.
Yeah, kind of loft style, get the curtain up and don't go behind that curtain.
Right, exactly.
That's so my closet.
It was like this third bedroom that we didn't use all that often, and now we're starting to use it more. And so it was time to get a door. But we live in really, really old houses. And so I had to find this specific door that kind of fit the style of the house, but also just it was in a regular size because it's a house.
It was triangular shaped.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It was a
circle door like a hobbit.
Exactly. Yeah. It was for a hobbit home. But the old homes used these really, really big doors. And so I needed something that kind of fit. Our house was built in the early 1900s, and I ended up finding a door from 1893 that this kid in the neighborhood.
Wait, how did you know that it was from 1893?
Because the kid in the neighborhood told me that it was.
Okay.
the guy that sold it to me.
It had the year stamped on it, I guess.
Right.
Maybe.
He pulled it out of a house that was built in 1893. So he was pulling out, that was being torn down, sadly enough. But so yeah, he was actually pulling out all these great pieces, mantles from fireplaces and these beautiful old hinges. Man, I got these hinges from him that are incredible. Like you've never seen hinges like this before until you've seen hinges from the 1800s. I mean,
you need to take a picture, or I need to come over and take a look at it, but yeah, we'll take a picture and share it with our listeners.
They're ornate as all get out, so they're beautiful. So I get this door and the hinges, and it was pretty inexpensive when you think about it. But I wanted to say, like, what I was so impressed with in this whole ordeal of getting this new door and hinges and hanging this door was this kid. He's a high school kid, and he has basically taken this job of finding old homes that are being torn down or where they're getting rid of these kind of priceless pieces. And he flips them. He sells them.
That's his side gig.
That's his side gig. So instead
or his
of...
his main gig, I guess, other than school.
Yeah.
Does he go to school?
He does. Okay. So it was funny. I was like, yeah, can I come by around like 9 o'clock? And he was like, I'll be in school. I was like, oh.
You're like,
oh.
What? Oh.
Okay. Oh, you're in high school. Okay. So I came
this by. This all makes sense now.
Right. I came by later in the afternoon, and man, it was just really cool. We talked for a little bit, and I just appreciated hearing that he's telling me like what his friends do for work. And he was like, this is just suited me really well. I can kind of work at my own schedule and actually make more money than I would working at like a fast food restaurant.
Yeah,
or something.
Dude, he's thinking like an entrepreneur. That's so cool.
Yeah. And I felt like there was something, a takeaway in that for all of us to kind of look where the opportunity is. He lives in this neighborhood of old homes, and people are always getting rid of stuff. But like one man's trash is another man's treasure. And that's what he's doing. He's turning those things that people are tossing away into actual cash. And when you think about, you know, the average, what does the average kid in high school make working at a job at a retail location or at a fast food restaurant? Probably $8 an hour. And he can do a good bit better than that, especially when he's getting the stuff for free and posting it on Facebook. And people in our neighborhood were always looking for hinges or old doors, you know?
Yeah, I need that random stuff to outfit our old homes. Well, that makes me think, I know you had a job in high school as working for a cell phone carrier. Like, were you dancing around in like the foam?
I did.
Foam, fake cell phone looking thing?
Not the best job I've ever had.
Other than that, though, did you have any other sort of like odd jobs that you did where you did something kind of weird like that where you were making money?
You know, that was the weirdest thing.
Okay.
Everything else was a little more traditional. At least, well, you know, I mowed lawns in the neighborhood.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Almost any kid did. But for the most part, no, that was the weirdest thing. And that was, I made a lot more money doing that when I was in high school. I had a normal job working at a fast food restaurant where I was making average money, like $6 an hour. And then dancing as a cell phone on the side of the road, I was making $15 an hour from those guys. Like, that was a sweet job when you're in high school, for sure.
That's awesome.
What's the weirdest job you've ever had, man?
Well, I was thinking about specifically when I was 11, me and my buddy, we started selling golf balls. So I grew up in Augusta, and I don't know if you've heard, but there are tons of golf courses in Augusta.
One in particular that's famous.
Yeah, one in particular that was famous. That's not the one where we sold golf balls.
I don't think they allow
but
that.
I mean, but literally, they're all basically on like every corner. It's sort of like a Mattress Firm here. Like you see them all over the place. That's how it is with golf courses in Augusta. But yeah, I grew up in a small golf course kind of neighborhood. And me and my buddy would go around and we would look for golf balls in the woods, in the creek, basically anywhere where golfers would hit them and where they couldn't find them. We would get them, load them up in our buckets, and then take them to the tee boxes where they have the golf ball washers built into the, you know, like there's a little trash can, there's a little towel, and there's a golf ball cleaner. And so we take the balls to the ball cleaners that were already there. They're already loaded with soap. We would wash them and then put them in the clean bucket. And then we would set up shop right there next to the tee box.
There you go.
And we made a pretty decent money, you know, in the summers as 11-year-olds selling golf balls. So that was my first sort of entrepreneurial venture as a kid. Something that was a little more off the beaten path, you know?
Yeah. I think it's a great example for kids that are Daniel's age, like to go out there and try something, maybe kind of see what void you can fill in the market where you live. But also, I think, that spoke to me as like, okay, well, how am I maximizing the opportunities that I have? What am I doing with the opportunities I see around me? Not just when it comes to making money, but I think that's something that we can all kind of learn a little bit from, like his willingness to kind of try something different, go out on his own, even as a high schooler. That's impressive.
Well, it's just also good to know now that you've got a door hookup. So I need to meet this guy because chances are I'll probably need a door here in the coming years. All right, Joel, let's introduce our beer for this episode. We've got another beer by Jackie O's Brewery. This one's called OG. It's a blueberry sour. And I am really excited to enjoy this one, man. Blueberry sours in particular are one of my favorite styles. And so I'm looking forward to talking about this one at the end of the episode.
Yeah, they're right up your alley. And yeah, we haven't had a bad beer from Jackie O's yet. So I'm excited to have this one. But now let's answer some listener questions, Matt. And for folks that are out there thinking, I've got a money question, I'd like to have that answered by Matt and Joel on the next Ask HTM episode. Well, go to our website, howtomoney.com/ask, submit your question there. We'd love to hear it and hopefully take it on an upcoming episode. So let's get to the first one now.
Hi guys, my name is Andrea from Boston, Massachusetts. I love listening to your podcast and all of the practical takeaways I get from it. I just listened to your refi episode, and my question is, my husband and I have excellent credit and good debt-to-income ratio. Our current mortgage rate is 3.875%, and we've owned our home for over 8 years, so we have good equity in the home. So, would it ever make sense to do a cash-out refinance and use that money to pay off my graduate student loans, which are approximately $48,000 at a rate of 6.5%? I would really appreciate any thoughts or advice. Thank you so much.
All right, Andrea, thanks so much for submitting your question, and we really appreciate you listening to the show as well. It sounds like you and your husband are in a solid financial position. With your loans at 6.5%, though, it's easy to see why it might be tempting to do a cash out refinance to pay those off, to pay off your student loans. You might be thinking to yourself, like, I can save around 3% right now on interest with where our mortgage interest rates are currently. However, there's just more to it, though, than just comparing interest rates. And that's what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, let's get into it, Matt. First, you really need to consider the cost of refinancing. And we covered that in the episode. It can be quite costly to refinance your mortgage. And these costs vary, but a standard cash out refinance could cost you anywhere between 2 and 6% of that new loan amount. So let's say your new mortgage is $200,000. The closing cost could be anywhere from like $4,000 to $12,000. And that's a lot of money that you could actually be putting towards your student loans in order to pay them off and take a huge bite out of that balance. On the other hand, if you actually just refinanced your student loans apart from your mortgage, well, that cost is zero. It's free. There are no closing costs involved with refinancing a student loan. So before you consider a cash out mortgage refinance, I would check and see if you can get into a lower rate refinancing your student loans on the private market.
Yeah, and Andrea, another temptation might be to roll the cost of that cash out refinance into the new loan amount, because it's easy to do that and it kind of feels like it's free because you don't really see those costs. But here's the thing, it's not free, you are paying for it. And in fact, you're paying more for it because you're financing it. And so don't be tempted into thinking that, oh, this is a cost we can kind of just absorb, kind of kick down the road because it's going to end up costing you even more.
Andrea's also got a really, really good rate on her mortgage right now, 3.875. She's not going to do better than that, especially getting a cash out refi. She's likely to have a higher rate on her mortgage, even if it's just small, for the next 30 years because of this.
Yeah. So, you know, Joel, you mentioned doing that student loan refinance. Andrea, you want to make sure that you're getting quotes from companies that specialize specifically in student loan refinancing. especially since the rates have dropped pretty significantly, it would be worth it to check with companies like Credible and SoFi. You want to avoid the bigger banks out there because they are not going to specialize in student loan refinancing and the rates aren't going to be as good. If you can get a lower rate, it would make sense to do that instead of the standard cash out refinance, since that would allow you to avoid those closing costs. And also, we're assuming that you currently have private student loans. If instead you have federal student loans, then there are a number of other factors to take into account. Our student loan pro, Megan, she's written a couple articles on the site to help our listeners to determine whether or not they should consolidate their loans, whether or not they should refinance. We'll put links to those articles in the show notes for this episode.
Yeah, it really is. Like, there's so many things to consider if you have federal student loans. Before you actually do refinance those into a private student loan, one of the biggest things is how quickly could we pay those off? And if you feel like you're in the position to where you could pay them off in short order and you're going to get a significant break in interest rate by refinancing from federal to private student loans, well, then in all likelihood, it makes sense for you. But that's something you want to look into, and you definitely want to read that article before you take action on that. Another option that's really interesting and that most people don't know about, like I actually had to do some more digging, Matt, when I found out about this option, is that there's this thing, if you can't qualify for a student loan rate that's anywhere near what your new mortgage refinance rate would be, well, there's this thing called the Student Loan Cash Out Refi, which is this Fannie Mae program that hasn't been around all that long. And the biggest benefits of this student loan cash out program are that you can avoid the higher costs and higher interest rate that come with a standard mortgage cash out refi. There are some restrictions. There are some specific hurdles that you need to meet in order to qualify for this program. The proceeds from the student loan cash out refi have to completely pay off at least one of your student loans, and you can't personally receive more than $2,000 or 2% of the loan amount. So this could be a perfect option for you. Check with mortgage lenders to see if they participate. SoFi is a company that does participate in this program, but there are still costs associated with this refi too. It's something worth looking into, comparing apples to apples with a cash out refi versus this student loan cash out refi. Just do your homework, but it's nice to know that this product exists and it's at least worth looking into.
Yeah, and maybe not just worth looking into, but I mean, this might be something that's like perfectly tailor fit just for your situation, Andrea. So yeah, hopefully that might work out.
It could drastically lower the closing cost, the upfront fees when you actually go through with the refi.
Yeah, but you know, otherwise, it sounds like you want to be done with these student loans just overall, right? And we totally get that. But rolling your student loans into your house, like that comes with its own risks, right? Before, as student loans, your debt is unsecured. So if you don't pay or you weren't able to pay, yeah, that'll hurt your credit score, but nothing else beyond that.
You don't lose your house because of it.
Yeah, exactly. So you roll it into your house and then it becomes a secured loan. And the bank now has something to go after, say, if you fell into hard times. So just know that there's no better way to knock out that student loan than by actually just paying down the remaining balance of $48,000 as fast as you can. If you have a 401k with an employer, you know, if you have that match, then make sure that you continue to contribute there, like up to that match. But then beyond that, put every single dollar that you have towards eliminating that balance. Even though those different cash out refinance options seem appealing, there's no substitute for getting after it and knocking out that loan the old fashioned way.
Yeah, rolling up your sleeves, getting to it, punching that student loan in the mouth, and hopefully getting that KO within 4 rounds, which means 4 years or less. That'd be awesome. If you can do that, that'd be great.
What if the rounds in boxing were actually 1 year long?
Well, you know,
like the longest fight ever.
I can't imagine how sluggish it would get after a little while. But I will say, I don't really ever watch boxing. It's not really my thing.
Yeah, me neither.
That's but Mike Tyson Punch-Out was a great game growing up, wasn't it?
It's a little before my time, but I do remember it. And I wonder if Mike Tyson actually plays his own game. I'm sure he does, right?
That's a good question. He might be too busy walking his pet tiger or something. I don't know. But all right, Matt, we got more questions to get to, including that one on Section 8 landlording. And we'll get to that right after the break.
All right, Joe, we are back from the break. We're taking listener questions, and we have one now that is in regards to contributing to multiple retirement accounts at once. Let's hear it.
Hi, my name is Andy. I'm a pharmacist from Southern Utah. We've heard a lot about Matt's SEP IRA because of his photography business, but I don't remember ever hearing if Joel is also contributing to a self-employed investment account using the income from the podcast and rentals. I fully fund my 403b account through my employer, and a couple of backdoor Roths for myself and my wife. But I have significant income from rentals, moonlighting as a pharmacist, and working as a university professor part-time. Do you have any guidance on how I can contribute to a self-employed retirement account while also contributing to my employer's retirement account?
Andy, you're moonlighting as a pharmacist? That's the first time I've ever heard someone say that. That is quite impressive. It sounds like you're just grinding, dude.
Yeah, not just that, but he teaches at a local university. He's got some rental properties. Dude's getting after it.
Yeah, he probably doesn't get a whole lot of sleep. But Andy, congrats, man. It sounds like you're doing great with your money. I have had a SEP IRA in the past. I actually rolled it over at one point into a Roth. There was this kind of special thing a couple of years ago where you could do it over 2 years and spread the tax out over 2 years. It was really just this one-time thing, so I took advantage of it. But I'm currently not funding my SEP IRA, but SEP IRAs, we haven't talked about them much on the show, Matt. They are just this beautiful, beautiful way for self-employed folks to take advantage of socking away loads of money for retirement.
Yeah, they are great. And I actually don't have a SEP, but a SEP stands for Simplified Employee Pension. But yeah, I don't have one, even though I have been self-employed for, over a decade now. But they are great plans and are especially attractive to sole proprietors and LLCs since they are incredibly easy to create. Pretty much any small business out there can establish a SEP just by filling out a single form. So the barrier to entry is incredibly low.
Yeah, and like we said just a second ago, it is great for being able to sock away lots of money. It's great for big savers. So not only are they super easy to create, but you can put away a ton more money in a SEP than you can in a traditional or a Roth IRA. So the limits for those, for people under the age of 50, are $6,000 a year. That's all you can put into a traditional or Roth IRA, which for a lot of us, that's still aspirational, right? Like that's a lot of money, $6,000 every year to be able to sock that away.
Yeah, it is.
And in a 401k, the amount that you can't go over is $19,000 for this year, according to the IRS. So even if you were maxing both of those out, that's $25,000. That is a whole lot of money to be putting away in retirement. But the SEP allows you to do something even crazier.
Yeah, what if you're a go-getter, Joel?
If you're a go-getter like Andy is, you can contribute up to $56,000 a year into a SEP IRA. So it's a fantastic place to be able to invest these massive amounts of money and shelter it from tax at the same time. The tax advantages are basically the same as contributing to a 401k or a traditional IRA. So you're taking that current tax benefit, and then when you withdraw the funds, that's when you're paying tax on that money.
And Andy, part of your question was you were wondering what you can do to contribute to both at the same time. And you can. That's the deal. Like you can contribute to a work retirement account like a 401k while also contributing to a SEP. That's not a problem. However, the IRS rules, they do get a little more complicated when you have other personal retirement accounts. So you'll want to probably check with an accountant since you mentioned having those Roths. But there is no problems with contributing to a work-sponsored retirement account like a 401k, as well as your own SEP.
That's kind of actually part of the beauty, I think, Matt, of having multiple forms of income, of having traditional employer income and then having income from another source, whether it's rental properties or like it's nice for one reason, right? That if you lose your job, you've got this other source of income coming in. But then it's also nice for being able to contribute more to different retirement accounts. And it sounds like Andy's taking full advantage of that. I appreciate that. And I think everybody else out there listening who does have income coming from a traditional employer-based source and then also self-employment income, it's just great to know that you can contribute to both. And that if you have a ton of money to sock away, that this SEP is just this great option. And you can open up a SEP with any of our favorite low-cost investment houses that we've talked about, Vanguard, Fidelity, super easy to do that. And you have access to all the great funds that they have to offer, and you can just invest inside of those inside of your SEP at the same time.
Yeah, bottom line, there are a ton of different ways to invest in tax-advantaged accounts. Joel, you actually just mentioned to me earlier today that you now have access to a healthcare-related means to saving for your future. You want to share with our listeners your new opportunity that you have?
Yeah, so it was just announced during open enrollment that we have access to an HSA for the first time ever next year. I'm signing up for our family up for the high deductible healthcare plan.
Yeah, good for you, man.
I'm maxing out the HSA. So yeah, I think too.
Get that triple tax advantage.
Oh, it's beautiful. If you want to know more about it, we did an episode on that. That was episode 105. But yeah, I think the reason, Andy, why I'm not contributing to a SEP, because you kind of hinted at that too, well, that's because I'm prioritizing the HSA prioritizing the 401k, prioritizing a Roth IRA, and then prioritizing investing in rental property. And so because of that, I don't have enough money left over to invest in a SEP. I don't even have enough money to come close to maximizing, you know, all of those accounts out. So I think, you know, those are my priorities right now in kind of that order, basically. Someday, maybe I'll get back into investing in a SEP IRA. But yeah, that's kind of where my head's at right now and where my money's going. All right, Matt, let's get to that next question.
Hi, Matt and Joel. My name is Grace, and I'm from Columbus, Georgia. I just finished 3 years as a Peace Corps volunteer in Senegal, West Africa, and I'm looking to jumpstart my personal wealth by buying an investment property. Although you guys have done plenty of podcasts on property management and being a landlord, I'm really interested in becoming a Section 8 landlord. Homelessness and poverty are issues in my hometown, and there are a lot of low-income people and families that need affordable housing. I want to help renew some of the historic areas in my hometown without pricing people out of areas that their families have lived in for generations. Have either of you rented to Section 8 recipients? What are the HUD requirements for aspiring Section 8 landlords? And is there a way to balance community renovation without it turning into gentrification? Thanks for the podcast, Jittig and Jeff.
Grace, those are some awesome questions. We, you know, we love where your heart is with this. You're obviously being really thoughtful with your money and how it is that you are looking to, you know, not only build your own wealth, but do that while also serving others. I think serving is kind of the best and the most fulfilling way to lead your life. Neither Joel nor I have dabbled in Section 8 housing before, but it's something that we have wrestled with, especially lately. So this is a great opportunity for us to kind of talk through this some and answer your questions at the same time.
I completely agree with what you said. I love Grace's heart in this. First, let's kind of define the terms. What is Section 8 housing and how do landlords specifically rent their homes in this manner? Basically, HUD, which is the Department of Housing and Urban Development, has funds that local public housing agencies can use to help people who can't afford market rent. And that agency will pay a portion or potentially all of the rent that the tenant owes directly to the landlord every month. So for lots of landlords, this is a huge plus. They're kind of guaranteed this income from the government as opposed to having to hope that the tenant pays their rent every month. And in addition to that, you kind of know that you're part of a program that is helping others that couldn't otherwise afford to live in your place. And so that's kind of what Section 8 housing is. And that's kind of a loose and quick framework for kind of thinking about how it works. And at the same time, you have actually kind of access to a wider pool of potential tenants. You'll actually have more people applying to rent your place if you meet the Section 8 guidelines and are able to rent to tenants that have a housing voucher. So you're likely to fill your vacancies faster in all likelihood if you become a Section 8 landlord. At the same time though, just make sure that you still stick to screening tenants appropriately. Call their previous landlord to verify that they've paid on time. If you decide to open up your house to folks with housing vouchers and kind of go the Section 8 route, I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great way to go. But you also have to make sure that you still continue to be a vigilant landlord that handles things in the way that you would, just as you were if you were running outside of the Section 8 system.
Yeah, and while those are some benefits, right, to being a Section 8 landlord, there are also some downsides. And the biggest one is that there are greater HUD requirements. You'll have to pass an inspection specifically, and not just one inspection to kind of get into the system, but every year there's a new inspection that you have to go through. And then within those inspections, there might be repairs that you didn't expect that might be required. This is by far the number one complaint that I've heard from Section 8 landlords. These inspections could pile you up with a list of repairs ordered by a local inspector that you don't even deem necessary, right? Like it all comes down to that specific inspector and what they felt needed to be done that day. But the fact is, now they have to be completed. In general, there's just a lot more red tape. It's not just the specific inspections, but just the overall bureaucracy and the government process. Like all of that takes a lot of time and that can gum things up and just would require a bit more patience from you as the landlord.
Yeah, and the last question Matt the Great Grace asked was specifically about gentrification. And this is something that I've personally wrestled with a lot. This is something that you and I have talked about a lot. We live in a neighborhood that has changed rapidly in kind of the 10 years that we've lived here. And some of it good, some of it bad. And some of the growth has been growth that we're not in favor of. And it's been at the expense of some of the people that have lived here for a long time. And so that is something that we're cognizant of, especially as landlords. And here's kind of where I've come down a little bit on this. From my experience, I feel like you have to focus on the things that you can actually control in how you handle your business with the individuals that you're renting to. the overall market forces are kind of too big for one person to slow them down. For instance, Matt, these Wall Street firms were coming in and buying massive amounts of housing stock where we live, and they were just jacking up the rent prices, and it was impossible to slow that down. Mom and pop landlords just couldn't do anything to change the facts on the ground. So I would say, personally, do your best to treat each tenant fairly. If you have a tenant that you would like to see stay in the home, don't raise the rent to market values specifically for that tenant so that you can keep them in the home. If it is still possible for you to do well with that property by not charging full market value for it, then I'm okay showing grace to that specific tenant in order to do that. And so for example, I bought a rental property in a neighborhood that's about 10 minutes away from where I live. And I love this part of town. It's one of my favorites. It's right next to my favorite disc golf course. And there was a lady in there, a lady and her son, and she was just an excellent tenant. And I knew that she didn't have the money to pay full market rent. And so I decided that for her specifically, I was more than willing to charge less money to let her remain in the home until she decided to move elsewhere. I didn't want to be the cause of her leaving the house. I wanted her to be able to stay there as someone who had been in the neighborhood and been a contributing part of that neighborhood for a long time. So I think as a landlord, you can, on a case-to-case basis, you can't undo the market forces that are at work. But what you can do is you can treat your tenants well, and you can also kind of show special kindness towards particular tenants where you feel it's warranted.
I think finding that balance between community renovation and full-on gentrification is tough. Grace, early on with my first couple of properties, I wanted to spend the money and I wanted to upgrade those properties in order to increase the amount of rent that I was going to be able to charge. I kind of like nice things and I wanted it to look nice, and that was sort of where my head was at the time. But like, therein lies the problem, right? Because we would have had to have increased the rents in order to see return on our investment. And that would have meant that there are going to be some folks who wouldn't be able to afford living there after that. In recent years, finding that balance for me has meant avoiding those fancy upgrades and not over-improving a property, but instead to provide a great safe and sanitary place for anyone to rent. And I said safe and sanitary because that is essentially the mission of HUD. Like, if you kind of look at their guidelines, the reason that they have those inspections and the reason they have all these different requirements is that they want to be able to provide housing that is a great place for folks to live. In the end, I think that there's a way that you can be involved in the mission of HUD, right? Like, where you can have the heart and the mission of what they're doing to be able to provide affordable housing for folks without necessarily joining the system, right? Without involving yourself in all of the red tape and the different inspections that HUD requires.
Yeah. On that note, Matt, though, I do think too that Section 8 landlording can be a smart move for a lot of people. And it's something that I actually plan on pursuing at some point. And I think this could be a really fulfilling thing to do in order to go through the process and get your home HUD certified for accepting housing vouchers. And then, but also you can build wealth at the same time. And actually, interestingly enough, you can actually make more money through Section 8 landlording than you can posting it on Zillow and getting market rent sometimes. I found that fascinating too. I've heard that from a lot of Section 8 landlords that sometimes, because of the way the government sets the market rate, it can be often more than what they could get just on the open market. So yeah, it's, Grace, I think this is a noble endeavor, and I think it's definitely worth looking into more. And it's something I plan on joining you in one of these days. I would go to HUD.gov in order to find the local agency that you need to apply with in order to get in the system. And then once you do that, like Matt said, you're going to have this inspection. You're going to have to make sure your house is shipshape and meets all the government guidelines, but then you're going to be ready. I think this is going to be great, not just for you and your wealth building, but your peace of mind as you're building your wealth. And then also good for some deserving family that needs help. And this program is one that has helped a lot of people to be able to afford housing that they otherwise wouldn't be able to.
Yeah. So Grace, hopefully this gave you some good thoughts, something to consider as you are pursuing your first property and pursuing Section 8 landlording. Joel, as you know, we've got a couple more questions, man. But first, let's take a quick break.
Matt, we're back and we're going to get to that question about lump sum investing. But first, let's talk about canceling a credit card.
Hey guys, Brian from Alaska calling. I was hoping you guys could maybe help my wife and I out with a little debate we've been having regarding available credit and credit to debt ratios and how they affect credit score. As it stands right now, my wife and I don't have any debt. We use our credit cards basically more like debit cards, and we pay them off at the end of every month. We don't have a home loan or a vehicle loan. All that's paid off. So the only way that we're really getting credit is through those credit cards that we have. Between the two of us, we probably have about $40,000 or $45,000 in available credit. But again, we don't really use any of it. My wife thinks that we should go through and we should close some of the credit cards that we have. That way we just don't have that available credit because we're not using it anyways. Well, I'm kind of the opinion that we should leave it open. That way our credit to debt ratio stays as high as possible. If you guys could help us out and just kind of answer those questions, that'd sure be helpful. Settle the debate in the household. I wish I could send you guys some beer here from Alaska, but can't put it in the mail. It's against the law. So I guess you guys are going to have to make your way up here to have some of it yourselves. Thanks for you guys' help, and I hope you guys can answer this question. Bye.
Ooh, Joel, it's a marital dispute. We love settling those, right?
My all-time favorite thing to do is to wade into other people's marriage and say, you're right, you're wrong.
Let's get all up in that drama.
Most def. By the way, I got to say, yeah, I've not had many beers from Alaska, but one that I did have was a barley wine from Anchorage Brewing Company called Deal with the Devil, and it was so tasty. So yeah, I wonder how those Alaska beers are, and I'm going to have to make a trip up there one day to have some more. But for now, I'll settle just fixing Brian's marriage for him, okay? First, Brian, congrats, man, on not having any debt. You are using those credit cards the way that they should be used. You don't have a mortgage or a car loan? Like, who are you? That's un-American, really. Un-American in the best way, though. So congratulations to you on those things.
Yeah, and it's not because the cost of living is less expensive up there. The cost True. Of living in Alaska is actually a little bit higher. It costs a lot of money to get the groceries through all the snow. So, Brian, yeah, congrats. That's pretty amazing. But here's the thing. You can tell your wife that we are sorry, but man, we're going to have to side with you. There is no reason for you to close those cards, especially because you guys handle your credit so well. Not only are you keeping that utilization rate low, but keeping those cards open, that'll help the age of your credit lines, that's another factor in determining your score. Just periodically, you do want to make sure that you are using those cards for just like a small purchase once a year. I've got two cards, and that's exactly what I do. I've got it on the calendar, and one time in the spring, one time in the fall, I use those cards to make the tiniest of all purchases and basically immediately pay that card off before the statement even hits. And that just kind of helps that dust from settling on those cards.
Yeah. Otherwise, if you're not using them, the credit card issuer is going to be like, huh, Brian doesn't like these cards. We're going to cancel them for him. And that's not what you want. So yeah, using them every so often is going to help keep those credit cards active. And you want to keep them active because, like you said, it is contributing to your overall low utilization rate. And it's also adding to the length of credit history. And those are the reasons that you keep credit cards open.
Yeah. And one other thing is Brian, he mentioned how he doesn't have any debt. He doesn't have any loans, right? He doesn't have a mortgage. He doesn't have a car note. And so that makes his credit cards even more important because he doesn't have that robust credit mix. He doesn't have those installment loans. He only has the revolving credit. And so Brian, that makes these credit cards even more important for you to keep your credit score up.
Yeah. I will say too, though, actually, interestingly enough, it sounds like Brian doesn't have a whole lot of need for credit. Yeah. with not having a mortgage, not having any other sorts of loans, which is great to not have need for it. But still, the credit score, as we've mentioned before, impacts other areas of your life when you're signing up for a cell phone plan sometimes, or the rate you're going to pay for auto or home insurance. So you want to make sure your credit score is in tip-top shape, and there's just no reason to close these credit cards. Basically, in my opinion, the only reason to actually close any credit card that you might have is if you can't handle it, like if you're going to be tempted to use it, and Brian doesn't sound like one of those people. And so if you can't handle having that in your life, well, then close it instead of using it to rack up too many purchases. And then the only other time that I would actually tell someone to close a credit card is if it has an annual fee and you're not receiving the benefit from that card that the annual fee requires. And so, yeah, those are the times that you would close one. Maybe Brian has a card with an annual fee and they just don't use that one much. And that one, well, that's okay to close that one. But if you're going to close a bunch of your credit cards and only keep a couple, I just don't think that's wise for you guys.
And one other thing too, you know, we joked about this being a marital dispute, but Brian, I think it's awesome that you and your wife are having these conversations talking about your money, right? It sounds like you are both interested and involved in your finances as a household. And so, man, kudos to you. Sounds like y'all are doing a great job on the communication front as well.
Yeah. So, Brian, thanks for your question. All right, Matt, we've got one more. Let's hear from listener Ryan.
Hey, guys. This is Ryan from Framingham, Massachusetts. I have a question about rolling over money from a 401k into an IRA. I was at my previous employer for a long time, about 18 years, and I have a pretty sizable amount of money that was invested in the 401k there. I opened up a IRA at Vanguard, and I rolled all the funds over from the 401k to that IRA. That money is currently sitting in essentially a money market account, so it's not invested in anything. And my question is, should I invest everything all in one lump sum into my target fund, which in my case is going to be a target retirement date fund, or should I portion that out over time so that I can take advantage of dollar cost averaging, considering the fact that I think the market is going to be coming up in turbulent times? I don't want to dump everything in right now when I have this sense that it's going to be at a high point. So my thought is to portion that out over the next year and a half and buy the target date fund in smaller chunks, basically. I'll talk to you later.
Ryan, nicely done. It sounds like you've done a fantastic job investing there at your former employer. And good job as well choosing a fantastic company. You went with Vanguard. They're one of our favorites. And worth mentioning as well, Chris from Toronto, he had a very similar question. So Chris, thank you for sending in your question as well. Hopefully we can kind of knock out two birds with one stone here.
Matt, who are these sick people throwing stones at birds though, right? I that analogy has always been a little odd to me. Like, yeah. Who's throwing stones at birds?
One of those sayings from the 1800s.
Birds are so sweet. Truly gentle creatures.
Well, have you ever had a pet bird?
I have not, but my mother-in-law has many, many pet birds. And she brings them when she comes to visit.
Oh, she's committed.
She's very committed. But they're sweet. They're beautiful.
Yeah, like the exotic kind, all different colors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I bet the kids love that too, right?
They do. They love to see them.
Well, Ryan, here, let's talk about investing. Specifically, investing a lump sum. This is going to be more of a question of our behavior and our ability to stomach loss than it is a question of math. There's that old saying, right, where time in the market is better than timing the market.
And that's a better saying than the birds in the stone thing.
Definitely. And it is absolutely true, though. We've been near, quote unquote, all-time highs for the past 7 years now. And so just think about the missed gains that someone didn't invest back in 2012. And so just know that historically, you would be better off putting all of your money in all at once because there is a massive opportunity cost to having your money sitting around as idle cash and not invested. So for folks who want to maximize their returns, lump sum investing, sometimes folks will call it front loading their investing as well, but that is going to be the smart way to go.
Yeah, Matt, lump sum, as you mentioned, is like totally the way to go based on historical factors, but dollar cost averaging is the way most people go. Let's quickly define dollar cost averaging and why that's typically the way people go. Basically, it's just the practice of investing a fixed amount of money into a fund at regular intervals, regardless of the cost of the fund. So when the market is up, your dollar buys less of that fund. But when the market is down, you're able to buy more. Basically, it smooths or averages out your costs over time. And most people just do that naturally in the way they invest, by a portion of their money being taken out every week or two, depending on their paycheck cycle, and put into a 401k or a 403b through work. Or they have a monthly auto withdrawal with their investment company and their IRA gets funded just through regular intervals.
Yeah, chances are if you have auto draft set up, you are by default dollar cost averaging.
Right. But in this instance, Ryan has this lump sum. And so, well, I guess the question you have to ask yourself, Ryan, is how crummy would it feel if a bear market came along right after you put that lump sum of money in? And if it would feel terrible, if you wouldn't be able to stomach it, then dollar cost averaging is your best bet. You're going to want to put those funds in, not all at one time, but over a fixed period of time in order to make it psychologically easier for you to actually put that money in the market.
And Ryan, here's the thing, because nobody can predict what the market will actually do, like we don't know which strategy will actually be better for you. Is it better to do the lump sum investing? Is it better to dollar cost average? We don't know. But here's the thing, regardless of whichever route you take, make sure that you make a plan, that you stick to it, and just don't look back, right? If you're looking to dollar cost average, you know, maybe what you can do is choose a shorter window. Maybe you can do like 4 months instead of 12 months. And then you can put 25% of your money into your target retirement fund on the first of each month. What this does is it takes the emotion out of the process and it gets your money in quickly without the worry of a big drop affecting your lump sum investment. But I think the most important thing for you to make sure that you are doing is that you are actually sticking to your course and that you have sort of the long game in mind. You don't want to make changes to your money based on short-term drops in the market. You know, those dips, they're going to hurt now. But when you're looking at it with a long lens, you know, like you're at the end of your career and you're looking back, those dips are going to be little blips on the radar compared to how they feel now. Just make sure that you're not avoiding investing altogether and avoiding the market, because you're afraid of that bear market happening now. Like, I mean, we could be at the bottom of another steep climb. Like, we just do not know what the market is going to do.
Yeah, Matt, I think ultimately I love kind of that truncated dollar cost averaging timeline, doing it in 4 months as opposed to a year, and doing it on a set schedule to take that emotion out of it, make sure that you're getting your money in, and also kind of avoiding that potential just devastating effect of that one lump sum going in and something happened. You're spreading it out just a little bit. And so I think that can help for us as we think about, you know, how we invest behaviorally. That's something I'm fascinated by. I think you have to take into consideration your behavior, your psychology as an investor. And I know a lot of people, myself probably included, sticking a large sum in and then seeing like a 30, 40% drop in the market, I'd get a pit in my stomach. And so, yeah, any way that you can kind of at least set yourself up for success when it comes to the way your brain thinks about that investment that you're doing, kind of automates it and makes it happen, I think that's really helpful.
Dude, 30% drop? I'd have more than a pit in my stomach. I'd be sad. That would totally suck.
I don't like sad, Matt. Not my favorite. My favorite version.
But I am a man of many emotions. So, all right, let's take it back to the beer. We had OG by Jackie O's Brewery. Joel, what were your thoughts on this particular brew?
Man, this one was really good. I know this is definitely your style, one of your faves, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
But man, I really enjoyed it too. It was kind of had these bright blueberry notes. And you know what I loved? I feel like they really didn't hold back on the amount of actual berries that they put into the barrel as it was aging. I feel like you got so much blueberry on the mouth. And sometimes blueberry beers, like I feel like the flavor of a blueberry can be a little harder to extract in a beer. So they put copious amounts of blueberries in it so that you really got the feel and the taste. And it really seeps through with every sip. So this beer was absolutely delightful. Jackie O's has not let us down. Their beers are truly remarkable. And this one was just another one that was, I would say, pretty much impeccable.
Yeah, I've had a number of blueberry sours in my day. And this, I mean, this might be at the top of the list, dude, for real. What really stood out with this beer is that the flavor, or the, specifically the depth of flavor, it went beyond just the fruit and just the sour. It mentioned on the label sort of that it has this mineral acidity. And I don't know if because I read that, it stuck in my mind, but it totally reminded me of mineral water. You know, like when you have mineral water and it kind of has this additional depth of flavor, it's not just kind of flat water. Like it's water that has like a soul to it. And specifically, it almost tasted like it had like a little bit of salt, like a little bit of brininess. And it just added this additional depth and complexity beyond the fruit, beyond the sour. And it had me licking my lips like long after the beer was gone.
Yeah, it was truly, truly good. We got to go to Ohio and visit Jackie O's one of these days, man. So good.
I'm kind of bummed we've only got one more of their beers left, but we can look forward to that one on our next episode.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, and Joel, let's not forget about our book giveaway as well. Last Monday, we talked with Kurt Steinhorst about staying focused in this age of distraction that we live in. If you haven't already listened to that episode, we would highly recommend it. We talked a lot about his book titled Can I Have Your Attention? And now we're ready to announce our winners who entered that giveaway by leaving us a review. So our randomly selected winners are J4636, 321 Roger, and Mar Marmy. So if that is you, congrats, and we'll be reaching out to you shortly to get you one of those three copies.
All right, buddy, that's going to do it for this episode. I always enjoy tackling listener questions. We'll have five more coming up in 2 weeks' time. And if you have a question you would like to submit for us to have on an upcoming Ask HDM episode, well, it's really easy to submit it. Just go to howtomoney.com/ask. There are simple instructions there for you to submit your question. It'll take just a couple of minutes. And then, you know what? Matt and I will do a deep dive and hopefully take your question on an upcoming episode. And we look forward to hearing from you.
Yeah, and Joel, you know, we would not be able to continue growing this show if it was not for the support of our listeners. So if you have found this episode helpful, you enjoy How to Money, we would appreciate if you not only left us a review over at Apple Podcasts, but just let a friend know who you want to have more conversations with regarding personal finances. This is something that we try to shine a light on. We want more people talking about their money. That's why we do this every single week on the show.
That's why we do it, man. We want people talking. We want people growing. We want people taking action. We want all those things.
Yes. Well, that's part of why we love the question episode so much, is because we're having a direct impact, hopefully, on someone's life and pointing them in the right direction.
Yeah. It's like, okay, now this is what I need to do based on what I heard. Yeah. And I agree. That's why they're so fun.
Yeah.
So, all right, buddy. Until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.